listen to the stories of Tinseltown. We got a new song, and yes we do. So come on days, and come on months, and all you others too. Listen to the stories of Tinseltown. They're not only good, they're true. True stories of Tinseltown. Ooh, ooh.
Hi everybody, and welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And guess what? I think this is season two. I'm going to say it's season two because it's September. I haven't done one for a while. And it's always like new seasons with TV, everything, going to school. This has always been new times for me, fall, because I love fall. So let's just say welcome to my new season. Who knows what season it is, but it's a new season. And I am thrilled, and you will be too, with my first guest of this whatever new season it is, Mr. Peter Riva. Thank you, Peter. I'm so thrilled to have you on again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking.
Oh, you were great the last time you were on. And so many people said how much they loved you, and you were just like the perfect guest, and I loved you. Do you even remember coming on my show? Do you? Be honest.
Of course.
Okay. Fingers crossed. Okay, you remembered.
We've exchanged too many emails for me to forget.
Of course, I know. Of course.
And I'm glad you're over your food poisoning.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness, you guys. I had 3 interviews scheduled last week. I had to cancel all of them. I did one yesterday, and they were great, but I wanted Peter to be the opener of my whatever season it is, and they'll go on, and then I have another one I'm doing tomorrow so that I have everything kind of put out there, but I was sick as a woof-woof, and I don't, like I said, I had funky chicken, and I don't really ever think I want to eat chicken again. That was how bad it was, but thank you for being so understanding and coming on now, and what Peter is doing for us. And Peter is also, I want to tell you, you have to go to peterriva.com. He is a sort of Renaissance man. You are an author. You are a producer. You lived in Africa, didn't you, for a while, and just were with the animals?
Over a period of time, I went so frequently, I did feel I could have been resident there. But no, I'd never lived there full time. I always went there to work and to undertake some activities that I really can't talk about, but looking after people and places. And I thought it's kind of fun. The real Africa is something that is close to my heart. I live here in southwest New Mexico, which, believe it or not, at 5,000 feet, sometimes feels like the Ngong Hills in Kenya.
Yeah.
But the people I knew in Africa and the reality of the people there really was a fun thing to write about. And Mbuno, particularly, who's the hero of my books, there's a character who's a television producer that's sort of sculpted after me, although he's 3 times more competent than I could ever be. But Mbuno in the book is absolutely accurate to who he was and who he told me about his father and how his father was able to talk to elephants. So, and that's embedded in my stories, which are thrillers, but fun.
Yes, yes, and they're doing very well. So you can check it out. You can find Peter's books on peterriva.com and find out more about Peter. Or you can go also to find his books on Amazon or anywhere they sell books. And
yeah.
They're fun. And great reviews. So that is that on Peter. And Peter is also the grandson, by the way, of Marlena Dietrich. And the son of Maria Riva, who I believe wrote one of the best celeb books ever. If it wasn't, you got to say it's like in the top 10 of celeb books.
But you know, the fun thing about that, Grace, is that my mother has this, and she was trained to have this memory in detail. In fact, people call it eidetic memory, but in a sense, it's more of a photographic memory in that she remembers images and scenes that way. And it's just one of those things that over the years, she wrote this book and put it in a safe at the publisher's until after Marlena had passed, because there was no point in making Marlena have to deal with 1,000 phone calls of, did you read page 42? And, you know, and Marlena knew Mom was writing the biography. In fact, she authorized her to write the only authorized biography. And when 2 years or 3 years after Marlena passed away, the Berlin Museum acquired, and we can talk about why the Berlin and not America in a minute, but the Berlin Museum acquired all the archive, which included all the letters written in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. At that time, people didn't phone, they wrote letters.
And how nice was that? Or they didn't text, happy birthday, you actually got a card.
Oh yeah, that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
and the fact is, what they found is all the dialogue in the book is lifted from the letters, and here's the kicker. Those letters were in all the letters prior to 1939 were in two crates in Paris since 1939, never opened.
Maria
didn't have them when she wrote the book. But her memory was such that she could recall word for word.
That's amazing. That is an amazing memory because she wrote a long book. And it was...
Bill Paley, who is the founder of CBS, at the dinner once explained to me that Maria was his favorite television actress in the early 50s because he could phone her up in a panic on Tuesday and say, Maria, dress rehearsal tomorrow night on a Playhouse 90 and goes live Thursday night. And he said she never, ever lost a line. And in fact, she used to be able to give other actors like Rod Steiger and Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau and everything their cues because she knew, she read it once, she knew it.
I'm amazed. Because that's we know that in our brains, our eyes take everything in. We see everything right now. You know, there's a bird outside, whatever. But will I remember it next week? No, I won't. Or maybe I will next week. But would I remember it in 20 or 30 years? No. But there's always a bird somewhere.
When you read her book, which has been republished and is really lovely, when you read it, there's clearly the training that was... she was put through from an early age, from 3, 4, and 5.
Wow.
Remember conversations at dinner table, to remember who said what at what time, and have to recount them to her father or her mother before she went to bed. This was her training. She never went to school. My mother never went to school. There was an actor, Brian Ahern, who took her aside and said, have you been given any books to read? And my mother answered, well, I read the scripts and I have to learn those for her. And he said, no, I'm going to introduce you to literature. And Brian Ahern took it upon himself to school my mother when she was a young teenager.
And she adored him. He was one of your grandmother's many paramours.
Well, Marlena would fall in love. And then, the problem with Marlena, and, hindsight's a wonderful thing. You can start to philosophically analyze. But if you think about a young woman who's a young teen when her father dies.
Right.
And then her mother remarries her father's best friend.
Yikes.
Which is fine. He was a good man. And then because of the First World War, he dies. Here's a woman whose maturity is stilted because of the war and the two fathers dying. And here she is 18. And she's basically still a young teen. So all her life, what she thought was love was just really infatuation, like a teenager's, I'm in love today with this one and that one and so on. So Marlena would fall in love with a song. She'd fall in love with a restaurant that cooks a perfect meal. She'd fall in love with a songwriter, a song. She fell in love with Paris. She would flip-flop through these loves. It doesn't mean she didn't have passion and love for all of them. And in fact, the men that she loved never, ever fell out of love with her, except for one, Gabin, but all the others, stayed dead true to her till they died.
Wow.
It's just, she was that powerful. She was that strong a presence, and she was that intelligent. But on the emotional side, she was kind of teenager-like, which was endearing because she was always young. Her spirit was always young, like a teenager, but she had wisdom and intelligence that people never really understood until they came in contact with her. You may remember Gorbachev. There was a coup attempt in Russia, and Gorbachev was under house arrest. And Marlena was incensed at this because she believed what he was doing was right. And she phoned from her bed in Paris, she phoned virtually every world leader and talked to them, Ronald Reagan and this one and that one. And when Gorbachev was eventually released from house arrest, he contacted her to say, thank you, some of the words that you said on my behalf reached me. The woman had that kind of connection.
That's
that
amazing.
Kind of power.
Wow. I wonder if that would work today. I don't think so. I don't
well,
know.
it was interesting because Nancy Reagan called me 2 days after they left the White House and said, I just tried to reach your grandmother, and I got the maid, and she wasn't there. Well, of course, I knew that was Marlena pretending to be the maid. She didn't at that moment want to speak to Nancy. And you know, I said, well, I assure you, Mrs. Reagan, everything is fine, everything. And Nancy Reagan said, no, you know, I'm concerned because the last phone call that Ronnie made from the White House was to Marlena. And I went, in my head, I went, let me see if I got this straight. The most powerful person on the planet, his last phone call from office was to an aging actress in France. People wouldn't, they're not going to believe this stuff. But the fact is, it wasn't because she was an actress. It wasn't because she was a performer. It's because she had the intellect and the guidance to give people when they needed it. She was that capable.
She was an amazing human being, let's face it. I mean, we all have our faults, and she certainly had hers, as everybody, but she was no doubt, I mean, that's why she's iconic. That's why she is, people still love her to this day. And because, not just because of her look, I mean, she was so much more than that. And by the way, the new book and the photo, oh my God, what an incredible photo on your mother's book.
Yeah,
for that.
That's great.
Okay, so you ready to take some questions?
Sure.
Okay, this is from my friend John DeLeo. He is a contributor to this show. He's been on about 10 times. He's written a bunch of books. And I really like this one. He said, did Marlene take herself seriously as a film actress and not just as a glamour star?
The answer is she had a spine of responsibility that today is lacking in most people. For her, performing, whether it be on stage or in film or television or radio, for her, performing was a responsibility and a duty that she had to respect and be as perfect as she possibly could. She didn't take herself seriously in the point of view of vanity. A lot of people think that, oh, she always wanted to look beautiful. She always, No. This was a woman without any sense of vanity whatsoever.
Which seems amazing to me.
I know. She didn't think of herself as beautiful, ever. She never thought of herself as physically desirable, No. But she understood other people saw her that way, and therefore she had a responsibility not to disillusion. It's the same reason that when she realized she could no longer, without extensive plastic surgery and everything else, which she was not interested in, this was a natural woman in all respects, all her life. And when she realized she couldn't maintain the image, she wasn't going to disappoint anybody, so she took herself ostensibly to bed in her apartment. And people say to me, oh, she wanted to be alone. I say, listen, I paid the phone bill, $5,000 a month. On this isn't somebody who was alone.
Right.
She wasn't alone for 150 pieces of correspondence a day with her secretary.
Amazing.
And on the phone all over the... No, he's not alone. It was all about a responsibility she had and the pleasure that she gave other people, particularly for her boys, the people from the military who fought in the Second World War, who she had a tremendous sense of duty and responsibility towards. And she referred to them always as her boys. If I can assure you that if veterans from the Second World War had phoned her up and said, Marlena, we know you've removed yourself from public view, but we need you. There's a need to continue the fight. She would have gotten out of bed even the day before she died and stood by their side. Well, such was her sense of duty and responsibility.
Well, she was pretty amazing. I think I'm going to move to this question then. This is also from my cousin Joe. He used to, you know, get me to do Marlena impressions before I really even knew who she was. He had me doing Charo and Mae West. Oh, Marlena, darling. But he loves her. And he was. He asked me this question because he knew that she did so much in World War II. When he asked, do you think Marlene was fully appreciated for all she did in World War II?
Well, I think the people who were with her there appreciated her fully. I think Harry Truman, who always thought her morals were a little weak, particularly when it came to generals, who loved her. I mean, General Gavin and his wife named their firstborn daughter Marlene because of his respect for her in the Second World War. I think Truman didn't like that much, but Roosevelt had told him that she deserves the Medal of Freedom, and the United States did give her the Medal of Freedom, pinned on her by generals, not by Truman, which was fine by all of us. She didn't do it to get a medal.
No.
Same, so did the Belgians, the Israelis, and so on. I think that, you know, Danny Thomas was the one who was always very funny about Marlene, because he was the comedian, she was the sex on their show. And Danny said, I should never have allowed her to decide where we're going. She tried to get us killed every single day. He was so funny. I'd see him for breakfast in L.A., and he'd say, yeah, the first thing is, if the sun was up, we had better be in the Jeep and ready to go to the front line so that we could entertain the troops. And we'd go this one and that one and that. And the USO, they had to chase us because we were ahead of them. They said, we're going to go set it up in Bastogne or someplace. No. She was already there. And we're in the Jeep and the truck and so on, going from place to place. And, of course, if anybody said she couldn't, she called Patton or she called General Gavin or she called Bradley. And, of course, they immediately made it happen. And he says it was ridiculous. He said there were some days where we did a performance for five guys in a foxhole with the howitzers flying overhead. And they were bemused the fact that we were there, and I'm doing my shtick, she's doing her shtick. And he says it was crazy. She tried to get us killed. I'm determined. I'm convinced she tried to get us killed. Of course, he's joking.
Yes, of course. But she was amazing. But you say here in your answer, you said by her boys, soldiers, no matter what uniform she was respected, yes. By the American public, not really.
Well, the public didn't really understand. You know, Clark Gable said it pretty well. When they did the tours for war bonds, before she was allowed to go and join the troops on the front line and entertain them, she and Clark Gable would, you know, get in these buses and trucks and things and go to all these little towns and go by train, and they'd raise money for the war by selling war bonds. Well, of course, Clark Gable said this, because he was the king of Hollywood. Let's bear in mind that he was number uno in Hollywood. And he was always furious that she raised more money than he did, because she said, there's daylight left. We can go to another town. And that's how she saw it. She saw it as a campaign, and she was relentless, and she finished. It's like Bette Davis said, when they went to the Hollywood canteen to entertain the soldiers before they're going off to the Pacific Theater, Marlena would show up, and she'd kiss a whole bunch of guys going in and go straight to the kitchen and start cooking, because she said they need good food. If they're going to fight well, they have to have good food. And Bette Davis would go in the kitchen and say, are you out of your mind? What they need is your legs. Get back up there and entertain them. I mean, you know, but Marlena's idea was, her job was to help these soldiers be ready to do the job they've got to do. So her boys and the families of the soldiers, they knew what Marlena was doing, and they appreciated her. The public always sort of thought, well, isn't she German?
You know, yeah, they kind of had that shifty idea about her or
something. They didn't get the point. They didn't understand that the only reason she didn't become an American in the early 30s was that she knew that the moment she became an American, the life of her mother, her sister, were probably forfeit. Or, even worse, they would be held as ransom for her not to, you know, assist the Allies. The second the United States, and this is 1939, before the United States was in the war, the second it became obvious to everybody, including her, that the war was coming, she said, okay, I got to stop placating the Germans. I become American now so that I can serve my country. She was an American through and through. And when she died in Paris, the French put a nice tricolore, their flag, on her coffin when it came out of the apartment. But at the ceremony in the Madeleine, she had an American flag on her, and she flew back to Berlin with the American flag. And we never put the German flag on her.
Did I read somewhere where some Germans were disrespectful about that?
Yeah, I mean, Helmut Kohl, the president, refused to come to the funeral because we hadn't put the German flag on her. But the point was, she was a Berliner, so I can put the Berlin rampant lion from her childhood on their coffin. But she was an American, so she was buried under an American flag.
Yeah. And so she, you had all the war stuff. We'll get into that later. I know how Germany did end up taking it. You offered it to the United States, which to me is just unbelievable that they didn't take it.
Well, bear in mind, there was no Academy Museum at the time.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Steven Spielberg, my brother Michael, who was working with Steven at the time. We had these conversations saying, are you kidding me? Every time you guys make a film, you burn all the drawings and
it's
the sketches and the costume design.
It's obscene to me from all these years.
Absolutely. And the preeminent art form of the 20th century was movies. And America was the home of the best movies made in the last century.
Oh, I can't
and
even
all
fathom.
Of that's been destroyed.
Yeah.
And the only reason some of it wasn't destroyed is people like Debbie Reynolds would swipe all her dresses when she came off a movie and keep them illegally. You know, everything else was just destroyed. I mean, Marlena kept what she could, and we paid storage over the years, 3 truckloads full of stuff. And when I tried to give it as historical artifact to the Museum of Modern Art, to the Metropolitan Museum, the LACMA in California, and so on, the Smithsonian. Well, maybe we'll take one or two photographs. And I said to one guy, I said, you're the photographic curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There are 25,000 photographs here of the preeminent photographers of the 20th century, and you're talking about taking one or two images? And his answer was, yes, but it's just film stock.
And it shows much more than that. Yeah, they didn't get it.
But on top of which, they don't understand what art is if they think that the preeminent art form of the 20th century isn't important.
I know.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
She's going to go on and on. Look what happens today. She's still popular. People have websites. People have things devoted to her. And
I get fan letters to her as if she's still alive because they've just seen a picture in which she stars and they haven't associated that the picture was done in the 30s.
Oh, wow. Do you answer them as
her? Which, by the way, it's fine by me,
yeah,
you know.
Well, that's kind of fine, but cute. Okay, so this is a new question. My friend Jeff, he asked about her association with von Sternberg. Was it all positive? And he wanted to know about the Rolls Royce. And you remember that question. And could he have it? But and I also read that there was a very negative article about Marlena's association with von Sternberg. And they have this digital library thing where they have movie magazines, fan magazines from the 20s on up. And one of them had a clip of saying that he takes control of Marlene's life, nothing about her husband, and he would like to ship her daughter Maria back to Germany. So that was a clip in one of the gossip rags about her association with von Sternberg.
Yeah, that's like reading the tabloids as you do the checkout of the supermarket today for Among Us. I think that the truth is that it shocked Hollywood that this incredibly sexy woman who's the big screen loved her on the big screen.
Oh, my, yes.
Idolized her. And they said, what? She got a daughter who's 6? How can a mother be that way? How can a mother be sexy? Mothers are not supposed to be sexy. This is the 30s. Today we understand it perfectly, but nobody back then could fathom that a married woman who has a 6-year-old child can be a vamp. Really? I mean, this is a shocking thing. as quite a few, you know, columnists at the time said, and it's just an unfortunate thing. Now, everybody knew that Marlena had a passion for von Sternberg and his genius. People still today, and I talked to Nicky von Sternberg about this, his son, they still don't understand what von Sternberg did to motion pictures. First of all, he introduced with sound, he used your ears to advance the next scene. Quite often when you watch his movies, you'll hear sounds from the next scene before the cut or before the fade that your ears are leading your eyes. That's a really interesting technique, and he's the one who did that. Now, every Star Wars movie, everything since then has done that. You hear the before you see the fade to Darth Vader. You know, it's the way he established the use of sound as one of the senses rather than an add-on. He made it the theme. The other thing he did is he understood lighting and backlighting in a way that nobody before him had understood. Marlena's halo glow of her golden hair was created by him with a Klieg light, a backlight, to make her hair shine without disrupting the scene or the camera or anything else. And so he knew what to do and how to position her. He also understood something about her, and it's why he hired her in the first place. She had command of herself. She was never insecure, because a lot of people said, oh, she doesn't give a damn, you know, she's a aristocratic, she's aloof. None of the above. She understood herself really well and therefore had no need to gesticulate. She had no need to question herself. So when she was performing a role, she was given a role to perform, she performed it perfectly as she was asked to. A few times in her life, she was asked to act a different role. And when she was asked to do those different things as an actress, she did it perfectly, which confused the hell out of everybody who studies motion pictures, because wait a second, here we got this idol of this woman, this sexy idol and everything. She can't act because she's just a presence on camera. And then they say, well, hang on a second. What did she do in Witness of the Prosecution?
Oh, she was fabulous in that.
What did she do in Touch of Evil? What did she do in The Blue Angel? Wait a second. She acted in those. That's weird. How is she able to be an actress and then not an actress? Because for her, she performed the role that she was given. The movies she made for Von Sternberg were performances, not acting. And she was given a role to play as a performer, and she did it perfectly. She lost her way in a couple of movies, you know, Rancho Notorious and things like that, because she had nobody who's telling her what she was supposed to be. The director only needed to tell her, this is who you are, this is what I want to see on the big screen, and she would do it perfectly. If they didn't have clear directions, she would get a little bit lost because she was trying to fit in and do the right thing for the other actors and actresses who were working their ass off.
Yeah.
That's why she loved Destry Rides Again so much.
Yes, and Eliza asked about this, and you discussed it in the last podcast, but she wondered if she got along with her co-star, James Stewart.
Oh, hell yeah.
We know she did.
Yeah, and you know, it's in my mother's book, unfortunately, mm-hmm. you know, the fact is Marlena had an abortion.
By Jimmy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jimmy's twins. And it's just one of those sad things in life. Accidents happen, I suppose. But the fact is, did they get along? Yeah, they were pals. And they remained pals the rest of his life. There wasn't... See, one of the things about Marlena is she wasn't competitive either. She didn't worry about somebody being more famous or richer or whatever.
Prettier or more beautiful or more or something like...
Certainly
like,
didn't bother her.
They would say, let's say Garbo and Dietrich. You know what? People always tried to make something out of that kind of thing.
Look, Garbo was a very talented theater actress.
Yes.
Who transitioned to movies with great difficulty. When you read any of the memoirs of the directors who directed her, Ninotchka or anything else, they go to great lengths to explain that they had to tell her to stop waving her arms around.
The theatrical gestures, to take it down.
Because it was from the stage. That's
right.
What she knew how to do. Marlena was the opposite. Marlena knew that the more still she was, the more rigid she was, the more the camera and the eye of the viewer had to go to her. When you're 20 feet high, your face is 20 feet high. You don't want to make a whole bunch of facial gestures. You want to keep it subtle. And subtlety was something that she understood from the medium very, very well.
A lot of people didn't, you know, and you know, not that they weren't good actors or actresses, but I, you know, they certainly kind of overdid it sort of with a tick or being too grand or whatever. And I think just the stillness of a performance and just being real, you know, and if you have to be hysterical as your character has to be hysterical, that's one thing. But I agree with you on that. I think that's the sign of a very good actor.
Well, Kramer in Judgment at Nuremberg, it was the hardest role that Marlene ever played.
Yes.
That was the most difficult for her because she had to say lines that were in a total anathema to who she was and what she knew the reality in Germany was.
Do you want to tell everybody who she played?
She played an aristocrat's wife, a general's wife, who had to befriend Spencer Tracy, who was the prosecutor who was living in her house. He was billeted there. And they became acquaintances, talking acquaintances with each other. And at one point, Marlena has to say, "We didn't know. You can't believe that we knew. It's impossible that you think that we knew." And the more she protested, the more it was obvious that, of course, they knew. They just turned a blind eye to it.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And to be perfectly honest with you, a lot of that is happening in America now. You look at Marlena would be on the phone every single day over the children put in cages at the border.
Marlena, come on, let's channel her.
That is inexcusable in our country. Inexcusable.
There are so many inexcusable things, and I think so many things that Marlena would have been, you know, on the phone.
Oh, yeah.
She would have been on the front lines. I totally believe it. And it makes me very sad.
Marlena's still fighting, though. The wonderful thing about her being buried in Berlin is that I get a phone call just after Christmas, because her birthday is the 26th of December, and a day or two, 3 days later, I get a phone call from the Deutsche Welle, the BBC, or somebody saying to me, you know, Reuters saying, "Isn't it awful? Your grandmother's grave has been desecrated with a swastika." And I say, "Well, that's not awful." And they go, "How can you say such a thing? That's a terrible thing. It's your grandmother." I said, "No, you're not listening. First of all, it's a piece of granite, and we can clean it and fix it. But secondly, more importantly, you people think the Nazis have left. They're in hiding, and Marlena brings them out of hiding, and I'm not sorry for that."
Oh, yeah, that's what I was reading about, how she, you know, they would do the Nazi insignia and write nasty things about her there. But you're right. And it's pretty scary, and I think these are just, I mean, with the virus and with everything, it's just such a, you know, how do we cope? I mean, 2020 has been one, and we're not done yet. That's the killer. And every day, it's something new.
Unfortunately, we're not done, and 21 may be even harder, and
yes,
we have to start buckling up. You know, there's a wonderful lesson to be learned from the greatness of our country in 1941. We went from being totally unprepared and in denial that there's anything wrong with the British and everybody fighting against the Japanese and the Nazis. And suddenly in 41, we're thrust into this. And by February of 42, we rallied all the industry, we rallied all the people, and we started moving forward. And in 43, Marlena was with the USO in Algiers and Italy and in France and then in Germany eventually. And she spent 2 years touring with the USO to prove a point. And Maria went in 1945, just after VE Day. She was doing theater and things for the troops as well. And there's a great ability of the American population, once it realizes the truth, to be able to make things better. And I think we're going to be facing that same situation again, where people just have to accept the reality and the truth and not go on pretending with the nonsense that we have to listen to.
Yeah, I don't know. I hear it loud and clear, and I don't know how anyone can't. And that's what frightens me, is that people just seem to not hear or see or want to, you know, just...
I think without Pearl Harbor, America might not have listened for another year, and then it would have been too late.
I agree. I agree with you.
200,000 of our fellow citizens, male, female, of all ages, passing away from a mishandling of this disease is pretty much close to a Pearl Harbor event in my mind.
And not having any empathy or sympathy or anything out there for these people, and saying that they don't matter.
It
is inexcusable, and it's not fake. And, you know, just people, I don't know why they won't wear masks. I'm not a political podcast, but geez, guys, wear masks. I had COVID. I'm luckily young enough, and I didn't have any of those other things. And I caught it from my friend who caught it when he was out at a last hurrah party. And one of the women was an older woman, and she died. And she died alone in a hospital with nobody could go see her. And this was at the end of March of this year. This is not baloney. There are people living in New York when it was no one there and all I heard were sirens. It was and not cops, ambulances.
I've lost friends. Yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
A good lesson here for people who are listening to this broadcast to realize that Czechoslovakia did a complete different thing. In early March, the president got on television and said, "We're in a national crisis. I'm shutting down the country. Everybody has to wear masks." And he laid out a set of rules that basically were seen as very draconian, but he shut the country down and made everybody go work from home that could work from home, but everybody had to wear a mask at all times, no exceptions. You should know that they stayed on top of the virus, and the end of May, they were able to open up slowly, end of June, fully open. They have less deaths per capita than any other country in Europe, and certainly less than America.
And they're doing well now.
Oh, they're doing fine now.
Yeah, they're
prepared to shut down the country tomorrow if there's an outbreak. I mean, they take it seriously to protect the population, protect the economy, and protect the people, the workers who have to deal with the illness.
I know.
It's inexcusable that we've put our doctors and nurses and hospitals at risk for no reason whatsoever other than we don't want to make American factories suddenly make PPE. By the way, I know some of those factory owners, and they say, "We can't sell our product because nobody's going to the store. I wish they would give us an order for PPE. We'd make them."
I know they would. So it's amazing to me. And, you know, it doesn't kill you to wear a mask. Some people think it's unpatriotic if they wear a mask. Come on, guys. You're protecting others. It's not a big deal. It's not emasculating. It's not whatever. I mean, a GOP senator or a lieutenant governor got out there before the rally and said, why don't you guys put on one of the Trump masks? And he got booed off the stage. Come on. It's not a big deal.
If you believe in a candidate, wear a mask with the candidate's name on it.
Exactly.
You're doing some good.
That's what he said.
You could look at it as doing some good, but nope.
It's a personal billboard for the dude, but... Okay, so enough of that, but this is what we're going through. And if Merlina were here now, beware, I wish. I just wish. Okay, so let's get back to this stuff. Now, your mom did not go to school, but there was this huge, this is true, and it was in your mom's book, that did she get kidnapped threats? Did Merlina get notes saying Maria was going to be kidnapped? Yes.
Yeah, there was a threat, an extortion threat, mm-hmm. which was taken seriously. And because your listeners have to know that this was after the Lindbergh kidnapping when the child, of course, was killed.
Yes.
And so there was a lot of worry. Hollywood was a place where you could go walk anywhere at the time, and there was no danger. But once you get a kidnap threat, then you have to take it seriously. And it did frighten the heck out of Marlene. It really did, because of the Lindbergh.
And she had bodyguards with Maria.
Yeah, that was easy. The studio has them. They just sent them over and dealt with it. It sort of hampered my mother's life more than anything else, although she liked some of her bodyguards.
I bet.
it's one of those unfortunate things that you think you're impervious to the outside world, and suddenly you realize how vulnerable you are. And that did ram home for Marlene, and it was tough for her.
I bet.
And for my grandfather, too.
I don't know who asked. I don't know the name. Did the gossip columnist know about her arrangement with Rudy? It didn't seem like Marlena hid things.
Well, you know, the thing is, there was a lot of negativity about that she was, sleeping with von Sternberg, and here she was a married woman with a child and everything. And so they phoned Rudy up in Paris and said, Rudy, get yourself over here. And they got on the train in Pasadena to show up in L.A. as the husband, wife, and child together. And Paramount made sure that that was photographed and put all in all the papers, that the husband and wife working together again. And then he, about a week later or 2 weeks later, he went back to Paris where he was living. You know, there was a morality clause at that time, and there was a lot of the German expression Sturm und Drang over thing of morality. It never really bothered Marlene, but she went along with it because the studio implored her to help them out and avoid public censure for morals clauses, you know, and she did. She went along with it. It always annoyed her. Look, when she could stand and do things when she wasn't being employed, she was between films, she would do it exactly what she wanted. There's the case of her going over to France, and she was going down to Paris, and on the Normandy coming over, she got a telegram that said, Miss Dietrich is reminded that it's against the law for women to wear men's clothing in Paris. And she went, oh, really? And she hadn't planned on wearing a man's suit because she had perfectly tailored suits. Mm-hmm. And when she was docked in the thing, she traveled down on the train from Le Havre to Paris wearing a man's suit and got off the train with the paparazzi, photographers, and everybody there. And the police escorted her because what were they going to do? Tell her she couldn't?
Right.
And the next day, the prefect of police sent her a bracelet with his apologies.
Wow. How could you resist her? She sort of had this way about her. This is from Eliza.
Sure.
Was she likable? Did she have to deal with problems in Hollywood? We kind of touched on this in Hollywood due to her German background. And she writes, very interesting for me because I am half German.
Well, you know, first of all, her being German, the best way to defeat that is for her to remind people that she was Berliner, and that's what she did quite often. Hemingway called her the Kraut. That was his way of dealing with it with humor.
Yes.
You know, wants to say anything against her, you got to go through Hemingway. I call her the Kraut. I think that she was so cosmopolitan, speaking several languages. She could talk to people with her broken Yiddish. She could talk to people in French. She could talk to people in a bit of Italian. She had, an Hochdeutsch in German. That's kind of like the Queen's English mm-hmm. in Britain. It's of a different status level. Therefore, she wasn't a commoner in any sense. So she would work her own way around that and pay no attention if anybody had any complaints about it. I think that as far as her being likable is concerned, she was adorable, is the word. She was so intelligent and so present and so not involved in herself. She would be involved with the people she was with. She was the person who would come into a room and sit at somebody's feet to listen to what they had to say, if the person had an intellect or talent or something else. I mean, Harold Arlen, who is a great songwriter, he wrote, Somewhere Over the Rainbow and all that for mm-hmm. the Wizard. That's Harold Arlen, and some other great songs. Harold Arlen said that nobody ever listened as well as Marlena did, because she wasn't involved in herself. She wasn't interested in people. People came to her and said, Marlena, tell me about this. Tell me about you. She said, well, that's clutch. Forget all that. What do you do? How are you? I mean, journalists, writers, cameramen, cable pullers, she knew them all because she listened to their story. She was interested in them for the excellence that they did. Now, if she was on stage and on the set and somebody was making a mistake, she'd point it out to them, because if it impacted the job that she had to do, she would make sure it was put right. It wasn't a question of not liking them. It was a question of, hey, I'm here to do a perfect job. You do yours perfectly. So she didn't suffer fools, but she wasn't cruel or mean to anybody. And by the way, if you had a sniffle or a cold, the next day on set she'd show up with a thermos of soup that she made overnight, especially for you. Now, bear in mind, finishing up her day at 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, going back to her house, dealing with my mother for 25 minutes, 30 minutes. The two of them go in the kitchen. They make soup because there's four guys on the set who have a cold. And so she's making thermoses for the four of them. And the maid, Rezi, was sent out to go and buy some more thermoses from Bullocks or something because she was running out of thermoses because they never brought them back because it came from Marlena, so they treasured it their whole life. So she'd bring soup in the morning. The call was for 4 o'clock in the morning on set by 5:30 in makeup and wardrobe. When did she sleep?
I know.
3 hours of sleep. I mean, this is discipline. It's like, I remember the costume woman, I'm trying to remember her name, I'm sorry, when she was at Drury Lane in London on stage performing her cabaret, and the woman was saying, well, Miss Dietrich, I think I need to take some of these dresses of yours and get them clean. And Marlene said, why do you have to get them clean? She says, well, you've worn it for 2 nights and it's very hot and surely they need cleaning. Marlene said, no, they shouldn't need cleaning. My mother went over, examined the garments. Marlene had just taken off. The armpits weren't wet. It was dry as a bone because Marlene had self-control enough of her body to not sweat when she was wearing her costume.
Wow. She can make her body not sweat.
Yeah.
That's discipline. Go, Marlene.
Absolutely did. There was no antiperspirant or anything like that. She knew that if she's wearing a skin tight, like an eel skin on her body, she better not sweat. It doesn't matter how hot the lights are and everything.
Amazing.
No, I'm not sweating.
Good for her. She could have taught so many classes and lessons for people today. Did Marlene have a favorite film that she was in?
You know, my mother asked her that, and the answer was she would talk about the ones that she thought she could have done better in. She never saw them again. She just remembered what happened in them. When Mom pressed her once, that I remember only once, saying, you know, what is the one that you're the most proud of? And she looked at my mother and she said, well, I think Morocco really stands out. And what she was trying to say, I think, was that I came to America and I broke every taboo I could possibly break in one picture. I dressed as a man. I kissed a woman full on the lips. I had an affair with the actor. I flirted with this one and that one. And I sang songs that could only be called bawdy. In her head, that's, I think, what she meant. She wanted to break stereotypes. She wanted to go beyond what was acceptable. Because she was always a trailblazer. Always.
Definitely. And what about you? Do you have a favorite film of your grandmother's?
Well, you see, you just said the word grandmother. So if I think grandmother, I think of No Highway in the Sky with Jimmy Stewart, because in that picture, she's my grandmother. She's not Marlena. She's actually the woman that whenever I was around her without cameras or anything else, that's exactly who she was.
Your gram. Yeah.
But if you ask me what I think her greatest performance was, there's so many that are really wonderful. I mean, I love Destry. I really admire Morocco tremendously and Shanghai Express because visually they're just such a...
They are. They're jewels.
Particularly Shanghai Express is just incredible. Desire also... The costumes in Desire are just remarkable. The picture I didn't like very much, but my God, the costumes are incredible. And you have to understand the work and labor that went into those costumes and how avant-garde they were at the time as far as materials and process of making the costumes and lighting them. I mean, as von Sternberg once said to her, you must think I'm a freaking genius if you think I can light 15 feathers coming out of the top of your head properly. And she pushed him creatively in ways that nobody else could. But as a picture that I think she really was magnificent in is the director's cut of Orson Welles' picture. I think, you know, the one that was put out was, they had to cut 20 minutes out of it, and it was easier to take her out than the other people because Chuck Heston and Janet Leigh and everything were there part of the plot. Marlene was sort of an add-on to the plot.
Right.
But if you see the director's cut, my God, is she good at that? Oh, she's good. I mean, as an actress, she's brilliant.
I like a lot of her roles, but it's so funny because last week I saw Stage Fright, and I was thinking about
what... Oh, she's great.
She is, and I'm the laziest girl in town. She's wonderful. And Hitchcock said that he kind of let her go in her own direction. She pretty much lit herself. She could have been a professional lighting designer because she knew everything. And oh my God, did she look, she's 50 years old. She looked absolutely stunningly beautiful in this film. And she also had an affair with Michael Wilding while doing this film, I believe.
Yeah, but that's, you know, Michael Wilding was the love of the day. So
he was cute. He was cute. And then he dumped her for Elizabeth Taylor. And somewhere I read that she was mad about it, but I can't imagine that she was.
You know, she wasn't so much mad about it it's kind of like, really? He's gonna prefer that over
me, a woman? Because I think Elizabeth was only about 21, perhaps 20.
Yeah, but you know, she understood it. I mean, it didn't bother her in the sense of jilted lover or anything. What bothered her was he could do better.
Yes. And someone asked, who were her favorite actors and actresses? Who did she really like and respect?
Well, I mean, Edward G.
I loved him. Yes.
His intellect and his sense of art and how genius he was in that was fantastic.
On Manpower, I mean,
she,
yes.
Yeah, she loved John Wayne. I mean, here's an interesting thing. Everybody always assumed the two of them were lovers because they flirted all the time.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly fine. But they were never lovers. As John Wayne told my mother once, I didn't want to be part of a stable.
And she must have laughed, I think.
Which Marlena would be perfectly happy with, because the weird thing about Marlena is she'd be in love with a man or woman, whatever, but she wasn't really interested in sex.
That's what I read.
That wasn't her thing. And if you look at her in that light, you understand that if sex has got to be done, okay, if that's what's going to make him happy, fine. You know, she can do that. But it's not for her. For her, it didn't mean nothing. What meant something to her was the holding hands.
The romance, the teen stuff, that kind of, and the old-time teen stuff.
That's right. And then same thing with Hemingway. The two of them were never lovers. When he was free, she wasn't. When she was free, he wasn't. And they remained best pals. They were, you know, joined at the hip as far as intellect is concerned. He'd send her his manuscripts to correct before he showed them to the editor.
Well, you said she was a voracious reader towards the end of her life. She had, like, all these mystery novels.
She always was a voracious reader, always. But towards she'd read one or two what used to be called, you know, paperback books, you know, thrillers or murder mysteries or Nio Marsh or whatever a day. I mean, she just, you know, TV wasn't that interesting to her, except tennis. She loved watching tennis.
Did you?
She loved John Ford.
She liked what?
John Borg, the tennis player.
Oh, yeah. He was cute. He was a little...
No, but she loved watching him play. She thought he was wonderful. And she didn't like Jimmy Connors because he was rude and everything. But she said, oh, of course, he's a better tennis player, but I like John Borg.
Yes. She liked her tennis. I'm looking here, Marlene. She, with you got to meet a lot of celebs through your grandmother, because you were not, she had Maria very young. Maria got married young, and she had her children young. So you knew when Marlena died.
I was born in 1950. I knew her for 42 years.
Wowee. Yeah, so you really knew Marlena. So
sure.
Who were some of your favorite people that you met through Marlena?
Well, you know, you got to understand that between my mother, who was a television actress in the 50s.
Right.
Who had dinner parties pretty much every night for the actors. They'd finish doing their live thing, and then, you know, or they'd finish doing the rehearsal in the afternoon and come and have dinner at the house before they went live that evening. So Michael, my brother, and I, we met everybody, from Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon and you know, Yul Brynner and all of them would come to our house, and Rod Steiger and Roddy McDowell and all those wonderful people. And they were just charming friends of my mother's that we didn't really associate, you know, how important people like
right.
Jack Lemmon.
Because you were so used to them.
He was just a sweetheart. He was just a really nice man.
Who?
Really. Jack Lemmon. He's just one of the nicest people you'd ever
meet.
Well,
yeah, that's what he comes across as, sort of, you know, the everyman. And he seems like he was a very nice man. I know he had his demons, as most of us do at some point in our lives.
But I liked him a lot. But funnily enough, I think of him and Tom Hanks as almost inseparable
really?
As far as talent and ability. Yeah, they both have that same openness and friendliness, and you'd want to be their friend. and it's a nice feeling, you know. You never have to worry that Tom Hanks is going to stab you in the back. And Jack Lemmon was exactly the same. You never have to worry being around him. He's just a great person. You could trust him. Lovely person. Anyway, so
you love
that
David
was in
Niven.
Our household. David Niven was one of the nicest people you would ever meet anywhere at any time. He was nice to me up until the year before he died. I'd see him somewhere in Switzerland, and he was just the nicest man. He loved my mom. He tried to get my mom. He and his partners had a studio, and they were underwriting a movie, retelling the Philadelphia story there, and he wanted mom to play the role, and mom said, you know, you need somebody who's more adorable on camera than I am and who is up and coming as an actress. You want to hire this girl. And David said, who are we talking about? And she said, Grace Kelly. And that's how Grace got the role.
Wow. But she was right. It was not a good part for Marlena. I don't believe.
No, for Maria. For Maria.
Oh, that for was. Maria. For your daughter. Yeah. For your mom. Wow.
Yeah. So as much, it was a nice thing that mom did for Grace, but of course,
oh my
mom
goodness,
said, maybe I ruined her life because she ended up married to the Rainiers. Anyway,
really, poor Grace. I never got that, but you know, whatever.
But Marlena's friends and people that knew her and adored her, you know, from Hemingway to Harold Arlen to, I mean, the trooping of people through her apartment. Michael and I would go to school, and then when mom was working, we sometimes were, if Marlena was in New York, we'd go to her apartment and we'd be there with her until mom could pick us up later mm-hmm. and stuff like that mm-hmm. in normal household stuff. So Mike and I had to sort of be quiet and stay out of the way if there were other people in the room with Marlena in her living room. And, you know, you'd meet a panoply of movers and shakers, from the heads of magazines to the heads of studios, lawyers, accountants, people like that who all wanted 10 minutes of her time or whatever. The elevator man in her building used to say, I'm a freaking chauffeur. I'm going up and down being a chauffeur. Because there were, you know, people would come up 5 minutes with her and then they'd leave. They'd be so happy they had the 5 minutes with her. You know, people like Patsevich, who owned Condé Nast at the time, you know, he was an aristocratic, intelligent man who was always, you know, polite and respectful. And Michael and I were brought up to be polite and respectful. I've gotten bad in my old age. and you know, it was nice talking with him, but there was no camaraderie or anything.
Yes.
Now, some of the people who came up, who were just fun to be with, was Yul Brynner. He was always fun to be with. He wanted to play cars or something with Michael and I in the back bedroom while Marlena was talking to somebody else. Hemingway was always intelligent and, you know, patting us on the head and that kind of thing and saying, you know, are you learning the piano? Sit down and play the piano for us. You know, Michael was playing piano. So there were moments in our lives as kids that were, to us, not so much as remarkable as treading time until we could get back home to our own toys and our own life.
Right.
Work and whatever. But it was always clear to Michael and I who was the boss in the room. No matter who came over to visit her, notice she never went to anybody else to visit them, or rarely. When they came over, she was the boss in the room. A couple of times Michael and I were picked up from school by her and taken over to Harold Arlen's house because she was working on some songs that she wanted to sing with him. And it was clear that we stayed in the kitchen while the two of them went off and worked where he had his piano and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then she'd pick us up and we'd go back to our house. Normally it was everybody coming to her. And it was like the queen is in residence, and people would come and see her for 5 or 10 minutes and then leave. She didn't have secretaries. She didn't have hangers-on, bodyguards, or anything like that. The paparazzi wouldn't dare photograph her as she came in and out of the apartment. It just wouldn't happen.
Which is odd. Well maybe today it would be different.
She'd call up the newspaper and the magazine and say, no, don't do it. And they would say, okay.
Oh, Marlene, she was actually very cool, I have to say. You said you met the Burtons in Switzerland,
well,
correct?
Well, you know, the funny thing about them is because you have to understand I went to a boarding school from the age of 12.
And in Switzerland, correct?
In Switzerland, right, mm-hmm. And is up in Gstaad. And Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, which Marlene always called the Taylors, not the Burtons. that's sort of an aside joke on her part.
Yeah.
And they would come and spend a couple of weeks. And, of course, it's a small town, so you met them and everything.
Yes.
And there was one time that I saw them, you know, and they were slip sliding. And so Michael and I helped them. Actually, not Michael and I. It was a friend of mine and I from school. We helped them down the side of a hill where they had the inappropriate shoes on. We knew about slush and snow. And so, you know, that you get to know them a little bit. A couple of years later, 1970, I was renting a little house in a town called South Morton outside London. And Elizabeth was broken up with Richard, and she would come and stay with two friends in the same town. And there was only one pub in the town, South Morton, and she'd be in there drinking Jack Daniels straight, and I'd be having a beer. And we got to talking and reminiscing about Gstaad and you know, the good times there and everything, and she hated skiing and hated to try to ski, and he wanted her to learn to ski, but he wouldn't ski, and there was funny moments. The thing that's interesting is if Marlena called and spoke to either of them, they were thrilled to hear from her. There was tremendous respect in both Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor for Marlena. Even though Elizabeth knew that Marlena sort of, I wouldn't say put her down, but felt that she was trying too hard. Mm-hmm. Now, later on, when Elizabeth got involved with the AIDS charities,
right,
Marlena turned 100% on her side and leaned on people to give her money. Because she said, well, she's doing something good. And that was very much of Marlena's character, to respect somebody if they did good. All sins were forgiven.
And she did good. She did very good,
yeah.
Elizabeth.
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, no, Afar was fantastic. I mean, just wonderful. Richard Burton was one of those great, incredible talents that Marlena had fantastic respect for, liked him immensely, but there was no attraction whatsoever because he was a damaged poet in her mind and not going to be reliable.
Right, and he was a damaged poet who drank a hell of a lot. And so did Elizabeth. And but I thought he was quite attractive myself.
Finish half a bottle of Jack Daniels with me sitting at the bar.
Jeez, can you imagine? I want to ask you, there's a couple. Marlene's, I believe this was her last acting role, I believe.
Just a Gigolo
in 1978. Did she mingle with other cast members?
My mother made sure it was a closed set.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was 100% control. The reason Marlena made that was because she'd been renting an apartment at 12 Avenue Montaigne in front of the Plaza Tene in mm-hmm. Paris. And she didn't believe that she should pay anything for le charge. Now, that's like maintenance on an apartment in
right.
New York.
Mm-hmm.
When you rent an apartment in New York, it includes all the fees. So she was paying rent on the apartment. She didn't see any reason that she should also be paying for maintenance. Let the guy who owns the apartment pay the maintenance. I'm paying him rent. Well, French law is a little different. She never bothered reading the lease. Her lawyer, Maître Cam, hadn't really appraised her properly. And eventually the owner of the apartment, who had to pay the maintenance charges, took her to court and sued her for the charges, and she needed $200,000 before she was going to be evicted. And Mom had gotten this phone call, which she appeared as a little cameo role, singing a song, Just a Gigolo, for this movie. David Bowie is starring in everything else, and Mom said, on one condition, no other actors, no other performers, no nothing, just her, the piano, cameraman, limited crew. I'll get her there. She'll do her thing. One day, shoot, then it's over. $200,000. That's how the bill was paid for the apartment.
Huh.
And the costume design was Marlena's with a veil.
Yes, so I remember that.
So not to disillusion the fan.
Yes, I remember that. I saw it once.
It's a particularly waste of time movie.
Yes, I only saw the part with Marlene because I wanted to just check that out. I was curious about it, and I found it on YouTube. Yeah, I didn't want to watch the movie. Someone
not
asked.
Not that David Bowie was bad. He's never bad. It's just the movie was
He's awful. Wonderful, yes. He was poor guy, died so young. Madonna, someone has copied Marlene's style a few times. Was Marlena aware of her, and what did she think of her?
She's aware because Christopher, Madonna's... First of all, I met Madonna in 1981 mm-hmm. and 2 when she was a photographer's model. At
yeah,
the
she wasn't famous yet.
And she was sweet as can be. I mean, really a nice person, really sweet person. And her brother, Christopher, is the artistic visionary and talent. And any costume, any outfit, anything Madonna's ever done has come from Christopher. And Christopher is a great fan of Marlena, and I would exchange books and ideas and photographs with him mm-hmm. to assist him in whatever he wanted to do. Marlena loved that kind of building on art of the past. You know, Marlena's a great student of the arts, and there's no painter alive that didn't capitalize on the painters that went before, sculptor
right.
today. That, well, same thing for her. She had no problem at all of people imitating, copying, improving, changing, growing. That was fine. She wasn't fond of Madonna's music. That is, wasn't her taste at all. She was more schmaltzy than that.
Yeah.
But as far as the performance and everything is great. What was a funny thing happened, though. In 2001, we published a book of memorabilia memories of Marlena with Knopf, and it's an illustrated book. And in the back, there's a list of her stage performances around the world. And the word got back to me by Christopher, or maybe it was Madonna or something, I can't remember, saying, hey, have I got this right? At the age of 65, she was doing 60 conferences a year? I can't do 60 now. How the hell did she do it?
She's amazing. That, you know, she was. I'm still, like, flabbergasted that she did not sweat with all those lights on her.
Yeah. No,
that woman had control and mind control. Good for her. She amazes
Yeah, I mean,
me.
have I told you the story of Joe Davis and I standing on the stage when they're adjusting the lights for her?
No.
Well, before her opening in London, you have to decide where the lighting is going to be for what song and everything. And Marlena's standing on her spot on the stage, which, by the way, she never needed a piece of tape. She knew exactly where the spot was and never missed it. I mean, the woman's precision was frightening. She's standing there, and the guy way up in the clouds is aiming the spotlight at her face because it's that Johnny song where it's just going to be your face illuminated. And he says, I think that's right, Miss Dietrich. And she says, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the right. And I said to Joe Davis, what the heck is this? The light's on. And he says, shush. So Marlena telling him, the guy in the cloud says, I think it's fine there, Miss Dietrich. And Joe Davis yells up, do exactly what Miss Dietrich says. Don't offer any more comment. So I'm quiet. The guy up in the clouds is quiet. She finally says, yeah, that's good. Lock that down. And she walks off the stage. I said to Joe, what was all that about? He says, she's the only woman, only performer, who knows how to set lights. And I said, well, how? And he said, that light is straight on her face. She knows it's perfectly centered when it begins to burn her eyes. So she was moving the light until it hurt her eyes.
Wow.
That's when she knew it was square on her face. That's the level of professionalism. She wasn't angry at the guy in the clouds. Yeah. She just knew better.
And it's amazing because, like they said, she could have been a light designer, and Hitchcock sort of said, do what you got to do. Do what it's not.
Oh, I mean, he knew better than to try and thwart her. That wasn't going to happen. That just wasn't going to happen. I mean, she's... Nope. Now, you can tell her, I don't want you to say that line, Marlene. I want to take this sentence out. You can do all of that because that's where you're the genius. She's not. She's fine with that. But don't tamper with the image. I know the image. I know how to control the image. I know exactly what the people are expecting. I owe it to them. And people today don't understand that the best actors and the best performers are the people who understand that it's not about them, it's about the people they owe it to.
Well, I don't think there's many people who feel that way anymore, Peter, to be honest with you. I think it's a different kind of time, and it's sort of like, here I am, and aren't I great? You know, everything. You could be on Instagram taking pictures of yourself 20 times, you know, in an hour. I think it's different. I don't believe that people really, you know, they get so much money for certain things. And I think, I'm sure there are a few, but I think not like your Marlena, no.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. She never had a picture of herself anywhere in any of her apartments.
And
ever.
Didn't Maximilian Schell say she had photos of herself all over her apartment?
Well, what happened is
The documentary, guys.
Yeah, Maria organized that he couldn't film her. And he said, well, what am I going to do? You know, that there's an empty apartment. It's boring. Mom said, build a set that looks like the apartment and decorate it the way you think that the fans are going to need. So instead of the pictures on the wall that Marlena had, which was all the great people that she knew in her life and that she loved, he put pictures of her everywhere in a fake apartment in his studio.
Yeah.
He never filmed in her apartment. He just made it look like
that. Ah. And I have to say, I'm amazed that she didn't have those photos of herself. Or did she have photos of herself with people she admired?
No. Never a picture of her. Just them.
I really respect that because if you look at some of these people's homes, you look and there is like a picture of them everywhere. And then they go, oh, there's a picture of me with this person, but it's really about look at me, look at me, look at me. So I really respect Marlena for
many reasons. The notion of a selfie would have been an anathema to her.
Yeah, could you imagine? She would just probably. I wish she was around just to give some phone calls and to do some stuff now. I would really love it. Now,
So do we all.
How's your mom doing?
She's doing great. She's 90. She's going to be 96 this year.
Wowza.
I mean, she's doing great.
Terrific. Say hi to Mom for me. Tell her I loved her book.
I will. Make sure she listens to this.
I love her. The book was so great, and I have told everybody, if you haven't read it, read it. Okay, so we're going to wind down, and I'm going to ask you kind of like, do you believe she loved you and your brothers a lot?
In the same way that you would love a baby, protective, supportive, interested up to a point.
Right.
But, you know, look, she looked upon me as the macher, the guy who can make things happen for her. She looked upon Michael as the artistic talent who's making great pictures. She looked upon Paul as a sweet, gentle person who will make a great father. She looked upon David as the youngest in the family who's, in her mind, was always going to be the youngest.
Yeah, of course, I mean, they are.
But did she ever ask about, did you do your homework, or are you doing well at school, or, you know, how's your job? That wouldn't be in her area of interest, because that's kind of my job to look after it. As long as I'm working, that's good.
Yeah. Did she give you hugs? And did she tell you she loved you? Because some people in that generation, look, my mother and I never said I loved you until I moved out of the house.
Marlena was a Prussian.
Yes.
She was a Prussian. The notion of going around hugging people wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
The fact that kids would go up and grab her and hug her, she'd hug back. That's fine. You know, but when I hadn't seen her for a while, I'd put my arms around her and she'd hug back, and then that was done. And then we'd go back to talking, and she was the boss.
Okay.
That's okay, you know. I mean, it wasn't a coldness. It was, is not this sloppy American emotionalism. It didn't appeal to her. It wasn't necessary for her to be true.
But you know what? Generations ago, that really wasn't the American way either. You know, the parents weren't like gushing and my kid, and, you know, kissy poo,
well,
and I love you and all that
the
stuff.
The thing that drove her nuts is when she heard the husband and wife talk about we're having a baby. She'd say, really? Who's having the baby? I mean, this whole notion of when you hear a man say, oh, I'm having a child. No, you're not. Your wife's having a child. You're increasing the size of your family. That's good news. But stop pretending you're having a child. That's nonsense. You know, and frankly, I think she's right about that. I'm sorry. I have two great guys, sons, and my wife bore them, and all the credit goes to her. I take absolutely no credit for that whatsoever.
Well, aren't you a good guy and a nice husband?
No, but that's the way it should be, for goodness sake.
Yeah, she's going through all the suffering and the whole body changes and everything else.
It doesn't mean I don't love them and look after them and take care of things.
Yes.
You do. But the notion that I had a child? No. I became a father.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, stop trying. Why? We're having a child. No, you're not. She is.
Well, you know, you got to take credit for something here, you know. Yes.
Yeah, well.
Well, just a little bit here. Okay, so this is going to be my final message for you, because I know we talked about how long we were going to go, and we are at an hour and 16 minutes. I could go on and on and on. Believe me, I love talking to you, Peter. But I think this is a good question to end with, because it really, I went, And this is a question from Lisa Hope, and she asks, what is the fondest memory of your grandmother?
She came and spent two nights in a little cottage I had rented in the Bramshill Forest in England, in a town called Eversley. And my wife and I hosted her for two nights at our house. And she loved being a hausfrau in the middle of a forest, cut off from any pressures of reality and phone calls or anything else for 2 days. And she just busied herself in the kitchen, would send us out to go down to the farm to get her fresh this or that, goose eggs, duck eggs, whatever she wanted. And for 2 days, she was just a grandmother who came to visit. And that's a very fond memory for both my wife and I.
And you also wrote, what you wrote was Stad 1966. And
well, that's
and the day of her passing.
Yeah, okay. Well, the day of her passing, she was actually quite remarkable, because she'd had a stroke and she could only say two words, yes, no.
Mm-hmm.
Very short, yes, no. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got her cleaned up and changed, and I carried her into the living room and put her on the sofa that she hadn't been in the living room in many years. And I called my mother on the phone, and I held the phone to her ear, and my mother talked to her, and she would say, yeah, no, yeah, no. And at one point she said, Maria. And I thought that was just so touching, that the third word out of a stroke, because of her strength of character and mind, she was able to use her daughter's name.
And that was on the day she died.
And then when we hung up, she was resting. The doctor said to us, it's okay. She's not going to pass away for 24, 48 hours. She's comfortable. The body is breaking down. And I said, you know, if she recovers, she's going to fire the nurse that we always put in here, because every time we put a nurse in her place, she called the police and had the poor woman arrested. Want anybody fussing her. But this time I said, that's enough. I can't do this to my mother anymore. My mother was coming on the next plane from New York to arrive this morning, and Marlena knew she was coming the next morning. So we've gone to the mayor's office to get permission in France to have medical control over her.
Right.
Her atmosphere and everything else, so she couldn't fire the nurse.
So it's and sort of like a hospice kind of thing.
It is kind of, but it's the French have this wonderful law that you can take control of somebody's life in portions. In America, you take 100% control. In France, you could take control of the nutrition, or you could take control of the medical, and we were taking control of the medical. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we were there. We got a phone call from the nurse saying, you better get back. We think she's passing. We got back, and indeed, she had already passed away. And the first thing in my head was, she knew Maria's coming. She doesn't want Maria to have to deal with this moment. Because that moment she knew was going to be painful. Because the public acclaim and, you know, mom shouldn't be faced with having to deal with her dead mother. So me being there, and I was always designated the person who should be in charge of her body when she died.
Were you with your wife or were you by yourself?
No, I was on my own. Sandy was back in New York. So anyway, we managed the day. So it was a good day. The other day, my happier memory, you want to talk about power of the woman. We were at the Gestapo Palace. Everybody, the Burtons were there, the Taylors were there. Paul Coward was there, Gunther Sachs, Brigitte Bardot. There's a bar area there with a terrace that maybe 150, 200 people standing around drinking. Mm-hmm. In anticipation of going to the cabaret and hearing her sing later on. And they were having drinks. And Michael and I were at the bar having Cokes because we were underage. And everybody's talking, making noise and everything else. You know, it's a bar scene. If you
festive
imagine.
Atmosphere.
Very elite bar scene, you know, with the snow outside. And,
oh, nice.
Anyway, this little door on the far end of the room opens up. And this wave of silence comes from that door all the way across the room till everybody is silent and not moving. She steps into the room. These very rich and famous people, I mean, some of the richest people on the planet, they parted like the Red Sea to allow her to walk across the room. Noel Coward was all the way the other side of the room up against the wall, holding court, as he always did. And she walks up to him, and as she gets to him, he opens his arm and he goes, Marlena, and hugs her. And at that moment, the Red Sea rejoined itself and everybody went back to chattering, but they're all watching her. And Michael and I looked at each other and went, holy cow, there's power.
That's amazing. And that must have been wonderful to see. So, yeah, I was curious about the day of her passing. So now I'm glad you cleared that one up. And Lisa, thank you for that. That was a nice question. And all I can say, Peter, is I have enjoyed this. I think I even had more fun in this talk than our first one. And guess what? I'm going to ask you to come on a third time. You better believe it. I love talking to you. And thank you so much for coming on. You can go to peterriva.com. And look about his books and his life and a lot of stuff there. Marlena's, your mother's book, Maria's book, is being re-released. Is it re-released now?
It is already, Marlene Dietrich. And we just did the audio, and that's available as well.
Oh, cool.
The whole book on tape.
So I will link all that up in Peter's website. And I want to say thank you so much. I so enjoyed this. This has been so much fun for me. Such a pleasure. You're
nice
wonderful.
You. All right. Thank you. You're kind.
Okay. Thanks, Peter. Take care.
Thanks, Grace.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody,
thank
for
you
listening. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And stay tuned for more True Stories of Tinseltown. I just love me some Peter Riva. I do. Okay. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Listen to the story.